From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Call it politics and public policy gone digital. Over the last decade, partisan arguments have migrated from the analog world of flyers and TV spots to the ones and zeros of the World Wide Web. Nasty attack ads have found a new platform on YouTube and other sites, while elected leaders have put their best digital foot forward on sites like whitehouse.gov and defenselick.mil. Millions of government websites and candidate pages, historical documents of today's politics. But come January 2009, most of it will evaporate into the ether. Candidates will take down their election sites and government sites will be plastered with the images and policy priorities of a new president. So a team of nonprofits and government agencies have begun an ambitious project to preserve the political internet as it is right now, and as it will be before and immediately after election night. Joining us to discuss this on Tech Tuesday is Martha Anderson, Director of Program Management for the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program at the Library of Congress. Martha Anderson, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Joining us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco is Chris Carpenter, Director of the Web Group at the Internet Archive. Chris Carpenter, thank you for joining us.
It's a delight to be here.
Come January, Barack Obama or John McCain's administration will be moving into the White House and the State Department, and almost overnight, whitehouse.gov and state.gov will change and we'll get new images, new content, and new focus. And if we don't look for ways to preserve the old stuff from the Bush administration, it could literally disappear in the ether. I'm getting a pretty Orwellian image in mind of some page in the Department of the Interior being erased and literally ceasing to exist, almost as if it never happened. Could that in fact happen, Martha Anderson?
Very possibly, if the new administration has such a drastic change in policy from the previous one. Now, some of the elements of the page would probably still exist, but the focus, the information that the agency would like to communicate to the American people will change.
The sites, the same, I guess, could be said for failed congressional runs and the sites of successful senators. Unless somebody captures them, their old sites will be taken down and they'll disappear, won't they, Chris Carpenter?
Absolutely. It's very common for candidates who do not succeed come election day, as soon as results are in, to pull down any websites that have been promoting their candidacy.
The Library of Congress and Internet Archive are part of a larger consortium that will take a snapshot of over 120 million web pages run by the federal government all before or slightly after this election. Tell us about that, Martha Anderson.
Well, we are taking advantage of the new trends in community building that the web has enabled, and we are working together with two libraries, University of North Texas and California Digital Library, and the Government Printing Office, to solicit the help of all government docs librarians across the country to be sure that we identify and collect the most important government agency websites during this time.
Chris Carpenter, this sounds like a kind of end-of-term harvest. What's the scope of this work?
Well, it's quite substantial. If you just look at the sheer number of web addresses that we are attempting to prioritize and catalog, for lack of a better way of describing it, There are over 5,000 web addresses that we know of, and these librarians are working diligently to identify for us what are the most important materials that need to be preserved. Now, we intend to create a snapshot of all of these resources, but we know that that timing is a factor, and certainly being able to move through this list in a logical fashion that says these are the materials that have to be captured first or as extensively as possible, that's really where we are looking for the greatest contribution.
Allow me to bring our audience in on this conversation. You can join it by calling 800-433-8850. That's 800-433-8850. Or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Have you ever noticed a subtle or significant change in the content of a government website and wondered whatever happened to the previous website? 800-433-8850 is the number to call on this Tech Tuesday. Over the last decade, American politics have really migrated online. Our political arguments, our fundraising, even our nastier attack ads have migrated from analog flyers and TV spots to the ones and zeros of the web world. In fact, many of our historic documents from this 2008 campaign all over the country will exist only in digital form. This presents a unique challenge, or a lot of unique challenges, for the people tasked with preserving that history, doesn't it? Can we effectively meet those challenges, Martha Anderson?
They are challenges. We the library began working with the Internet Archive in the year 2000 to capture candidate websites for the presidential election in 2000. And that was a small collection. It was kind of rough and ready because the technology wasn't exactly ready to help us do a thorough job. But we did the best we could, and we were able to have some record of the presence of that election on the web. Since then, the library has worked every 2 years, every time Congress has an election, every time the presidency has an election, to capture those candidate sites, to capture nonprofit kind of citizen advocacy sites, and to try and capture the whole of the American discourse during the election that we can that's on the web. But in 2006, we faced a really big technical challenge. We found out that instead of keeping all the files on a single computer to serve it out to the web, which makes it easier for us to collect, candidates began linking off to MySpace and to Flickr, and that made our job a lot more challenging. And Chris may be able to give a little bit more information about how the robot works.
Chris Carpenter?
Yes, basically the robot, as Martha described, is nothing more than a software program that takes a list of addresses out on the web and a set of rules for how information is to be requested and collected from those resources. And the software actually goes out and tries to automate the collection of these materials. In truth, it would be nice if it worked perfectly that way. the reality is that it takes an expert crawl engineer overseeing the harvest process, looking for signs that materials have been either missed and or there might be something in the design of a particular web page that causes the program to get stuck. For example, a calendar. You can go out to the year 2000, and as an automated software program, there's no intelligence there that says this is not appropriate. We're nowhere near the year 3000. So that's just an example of some of the challenges. And certainly it also requires some quality assurance on the part of experts, usually curators within either the Library of Congress or a similar institution, to go back and look at the materials and say, there's something not quite right with this particular set of pages. Perhaps we need to look at a particular file. And some of the new publishing models on the web are particularly challenging because a page might be displayed to a user the way you see it in your browser, but in fact, there are probably 15 different locations out on the web where that material is being compiled from. So it can be very challenging to pull all of the materials together to allow an archive to then show that page to you, you know, 5 years from now.
Chris Carpenter is director of the web group at the Internet Archive. She joins us from studios in San Francisco. Joining us in our Washington studio is Martha Anderson, director of program management for the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program at the Library of Congress. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Chris, I am fascinated by this crawler software program. I went back into our old websites here on WAMU 88.5, going back to maybe 1998. What you find is more than just a snapshot, is it not? The crawler actually records multiple layers of old websites, which allow you to follow through to content even deeper in the website.
Yes. So rather than taking just an image or a one-time representation of the website, the crawler actually asks the website server to provide it with all the files required to actually make the page visible. So this is a little bit different from what some crawlers are engaged in. Many crawlers that are used for the purposes of supporting search engines, for example, only ask for the text. They might, you know, pull the text back in order to index it and make it searchable. But because of the mission that our institutions have, we need to be able to try to represent that website as it was intended to be experienced by the user at a point in time. So we really want to try to collect as much of the materials that went into the creation of that site as we can. Now, it's a little bit challenging in this modern age because so many programs on the server itself now generate elements of the page and aspects of the experience. But we often partner with webmasters to try to come up with creative ways to collect or represent those aspects of the experience, even if the crawler is unable to collect them.
Well, we're certainly impressed. We went to defenselink.mil for May 5th, 2001, and we were able to click through the homepage to biographies of Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz as they were on that day. Allow me to go to the telephones. Here is Jeff at George Mason University in Virginia. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This question, I guess, would be a follow-up to what Chris has just spoken about. First off, I'd like to say that I really appreciate the Internet Archive, and I found it to be quite useful in the past in viewing static web pages. But as you just said, how would the new software address PHP or ASP or maybe Cold Fusion server models where things are stored dynamically and called for through the system, how are we going to recreate that sort of server experience for a user nowadays?
I'm so glad you asked Chris that question and not me. Go ahead, Chris.
Thanks for that question, Jeff. That's a really good one. I think there are two approaches that we've taken to this. Clearly, we are collecting what is accessible from each of these resources, taking advantage of sitemaps and other methodologies that were developed to support search engines that often a site will publish in a format that you can at least collect the core information of that resource, even if you can't completely recreate the experience. But one of the things that we found really encouraging is that there are universities all over the United States that have research and development groups that are actively engaged in trying to figure out how could website publishers actually share elements of server-side code that would allow you to replicate the experiences that you described. So whether it's Cold Fusion or you know, some other dynamic display element, you know, what are the mechanisms that we can use now to try to collect some of the scripts and elements that make those features possible, but not just today, but, you know, 5 years from now, actually be able to re-render those as they were intended.
Jeff, thank you very much for your call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our Tech Tuesday conversation, Snapshots of Politics on the Internet. Still inviting your calls, 800-433-8850. What digital technology and websites do you think are most historically significant? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi.
and good afternoon. You're listening to WAMU 88.5. I'm Stephanie Kay.
Next time on Tell Me More, it's our weekly visit with the Mocha Moms, our roundtable of mothers and fathers who offer their advice on everything from housework to homework to creating a balance between career and kids.
There are days that we do nothing but watch television and we just enjoy being together. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's the Hallmark card.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join the Mochas next time on Tell Me More.
Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
On the next Fresh Air, some of the potential conflicts of interest in the Wall Street bailout. We talk with Gretchen Morgenson, a business reporter and columnist for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's Fresh Air coming up this afternoon at 3 right here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the Washington Examiner newspaper, official print sponsor of the Virginia Wine Festival at the Prince William County Fairground from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. September 27th and 28th. Details and directions at dcexaminer.com.
70 degrees in Northwest Washington at 1222.
Welcome back. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about snapshots of politics on the internet, how you can find websites in their original form, even though they may either have been taken down or have evolved since then. We're talking with Martha Anderson, Director of Program Management for the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program at the Library of Congress, and Chris Carpenter, Director of the Web Group at the Internet Archive. Chris Carpenter, our last caller, Jeff, talked about how useful he has found the Internet Archive to be. For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you tell us exactly what the Internet Archive is and does?
The Internet Archive is a digital library that encompasses a wide range of materials that were either published directly to the web and or were digitized from traditional physical materials. We have collections of books, audio, recordings, images, web pages. There's a huge spectrum of materials. The volume of collections exceeds several petabytes of data now. So that's that was petabytes.
Yes.
It's a very, very large amount of information.
Thank you.
That is publicly accessible on a permanent basis. The mission of the archive is to take public domain materials and to make them accessible in perpetuity.
We're familiar with terabyte. And that's a large amount of information. My Latin is a bit flawed. What's a petabyte?
Petabyte is an order of magnitude on a terabyte. So if you have 1,000 terabytes, roughly, thereabouts, 1,034, I believe, is the precise ratio, then you have a petabyte.
Martha Anderson, we talked earlier about the Library of Congress maintaining campaign websites of all federal races for the last few election cycles. How is that information being used by researchers? What kinds of projects are currently using these archival images and content?
We've had some researchers who are interested in the internet, and they analyze these sites for the kinds of presentations they make. We've had researchers who are interested in the history of the political process, who are looking for what messages are coming from the websites, from the candidates. What do they emphasize? How do they present themselves on the web? Our Congressional Research Service uses the not the election sites so much, but the capture of the congressional websites to inform their policy work as they try to do analysis. In the future, social scientists, historians, students of government will find these fascinating, as will the American citizen who just wants to go back and look and see, now, when did my favorite candidate run, and what did their picture look like, and did they include certain things on their site that I think I remember?
So we can go to the Pentagon website the day
before we invaded Iraq, see what was there, then we go back again maybe 2 or 3 days later and see what the website looked like then.
Possibly if we had captured it around that time. So that's why the frequency of capture, meaning how often you collect the site, makes a difference. Usually, in the very beginning of the Internet, government websites changed really fast. There was a number put out there that the average life of a government website was 44 days. Well, I attribute that personally to the changes in technology. Government organizations were trying to get a handle on how to communicate via the web, and they were also trying to get a handle on what kind of resources do we need to serve this from the web, what kind of equipment do we need, what kind of software do we need, and so there was a lot of change. Over time now, I think we're finding that websites change because of events in public events and events in changes of power. So we see that at election time. We have a collection at the library of the Supreme Court nominations. Mm-hmm. So we see that as another change of leadership, so to speak, across the government. And so if we didn't capture it the day before,
sure.
Then we might have it a few days before, a few months before, and then we'll have it after that. So there'll be kind of a range of time, but not necessarily each day.
Okay, I won't quibble. Here's Dan. Here's Dan in Washington, D.C. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. I was wondering how they capture new media and all the blogs with their interconnected nature and their time-sensitive nature, because they're such a driving force in public opinion these days, but they also seem impossible to archive. I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you for your call, Dan. Chris Carpenter?
So in terms of blogs, actually, those we've been very successful at capturing, and I'll let Martha speak to one of the projects that she has going on at the Library of Congress that we help support. That's a great example of this. Some of the other sites that are more specifically social networks, those clearly are very significant challenge to capture the actual experience that a user might be engaged in, because the publicly accessible pages that you see when you are not logged into the network, are very limited. Most of the activity revolves around your personal network that you've generated, within that community environment. And so we've actually been brainstorming on creative ways that in the future we might get permission from a user, for example, where you could almost, for lack of a better way of describing this, kind of sit on their shoulder and experience their world as they're experiencing it, and with their permission, of course, as a representation of what that particular community environment or gaming environment. There's lots of examples in both entertainment and public policy that this can come forth.
And now the project that she mentioned that you're working on.
A couple of years ago, the librarians in the Law Library of Congress realized that they were missing some valuable information in legal discourse. These kinds of arguments were usually put forth in printed journals, and those printed journals were going away. And as they looked around, they found out that the discussion had been picked up on the web through legal blogs. And there's actually a term, blog, B-L-A-W-G, that refers to this activity. So they decided they would like to begin to identify the expert blogs that were out there. And to date, I think they have a little over 100. We've collected for them for almost 2 years now. We're getting ready to make them publicly available within the next month on the library's website through the Law Library homepage.
And there are a lot of links to everything that was mentioned here that you'll find on our website at kojoshow.org. Allow me to go to Joel in Columbia, Maryland. Joel, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you for having me. I wanted to comment on the Wayback Machine.
Yes.
I've had a chance to use that. I work in local government, and it's been really handy for me because, initiatives come and go, and sometimes you kind of have to get back to the way things were presented a few years ago. And you you don't always have that any longer. It might be that you're coming in after somebody else, and the original documents aren't there anymore, and the website's been rebranded, and so it's been. I've used it several times now, and have found it very helpful. So this type of technology.
Yes, we've also found it pretty helpful. As a matter of fact, we've linked it to our webpage, kojoshow.org, where if you go to our webpage, you will find what our website looked like back in 1998. But Chris Carpenter, this is a huge and ambitious project, isn't it?
It is. And one of the things that we've attempted to do is clearly try to improve the level of access to the web archive that the Internet Archive hosts. But we also have a team of open source software developers that have taken the Wayback Machine, for example, and made it an open source program that's available to libraries, archives, memory institutions, government institutions, anyone who has a collection of materials that they would like to make accessible using that particular technology.
Joel, thank you very much for your call. On now to Mark in Dahlgren, Virginia. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Kojo, thank you for letting me contribute to your show.
You're welcome.
My concern is about copyright law, in particular the law that I have learned to loathe, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my problem. If you have a government site, the president or the Congress can give the authority to archive anything that's there. But when you're talking about candidate websites, bloggers' websites, or other websites that are private, anything that's up there is copyrighted material of the creator. And in particular, we were talking about images just before.
Sure.
An image rights owner may give the candidate the right to post an image on his website, but the candidate cannot give the archive the right to post that image on their website. And I was wondering whether the Congress was contemplating or has already created an exemption that if a subject matter is of public concern, that these copyright nuisances would be obviated and we could just go ahead and save things without worrying about these copyright issues, or whether this is a serious problem that needs to be addressed.
You know, this is something that the Library of Congress has to deal with all the time, Martha Anderson.
Mark, thank you very much for that question. The program that I represent, the National Digital Preservation Program, has conducted a two-year study with rights lawyers and for publications and librarians to address just this very issue. It's a section of the Copyright Act called the Section 108, and it defines what libraries and archives can do in the name of preservation with materials. And until it does not currently address digital materials, particularly the web. And the study was published in March. I think you can find it on the Library of Congress website, and it has recommendations. Those recommendations have gone forward to the Copyright Office. So we hope that there will be some progress in this area in the coming months and years to allow this. But you very much identify our problem. Right now, the way we deal with it is we request permission to collect the site, and it takes a great deal of time. For election 2004, it took over 2,000 staff hours to track down people to ask permission for. Of that, we only got about a 20%.
I knew it was less than 40%, but it was only about 20%.
Yeah, it was only about 20% that said, yes, you can display this site publicly. And but that has risen. Now, for the legal blogs, we have almost 100%. It's in the 90s, of responses to our request to collect. With that said, we don't make our archives publicly available until we can clear rights on them. So that's why there's a delay. You'll see election 2000, 2004 on our site, or 2002, but 2004 and 2006 will be coming pretty shortly.
Chris Carpenter, I guess this is an issue that you also have to deal with in a major way at Internet Archive.
We do, and we're in a unique position. We're a not-for-profit versus a branch of the government. So we are able to take the position that the most important element is providing access to these materials. If we receive a request from a site owner or publisher to make the information not accessible, then we do respect that. But we make it publicly accessible, and it's up to the owners of the content to contact us if they choose not to have it publicly accessible.
800-433-8850 is the number to call to participate in this Tech Tuesday conversation on snapshots of politics on the Internet. Do you see any uses in preserving old websites or current websites as they once were? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You both employ curators who are supposed to make the determination of what kinds of stuff should be saved. How does one determine what's historically noteworthy and what isn't?
Very challenging question. At the library, we have subject experts, people who have are considered leading in their field of study, who have dealt with materials, collecting materials for the library for many, many years. When the web presented itself, there was a bit of a shift of understanding the materials. At first, they all wanted to treat it like a current reference set, but then to think of it as the primary source. As one pundit once said about newspapers, it was that they're the first draft of history. Well, now websites are becoming the first draft of history. So how to deal with that? So they build upon their experience in their discipline, usually, to identify topics or subjects of interest, and then look at the sites. Sometimes a site can be selected that people may think, well, you should only collect authoritative sites. But during the elections, we try to collect a broad spectrum of public views of the election. And in 2004, we even collected jibjab.com, and they mentioned us on television. They were very proud to be selected, but it showed political humor, and that was one thing the curators felt should be a part of the whole collection.
Curators, the use of curators in your case, Chris Carpenter?
We don't have traditional curators in the sense that you do at an institution like the Library of Congress or the California Digital Library, for example. Instead, we employ technology experts, experts on web publishing, methodologies and approaches, experts on content in terms of what does make its way into the web environment. And what we're primarily focused on when we're engaged in collection specifically for the Internet Archive is we tend to create or generate comprehensive snapshots of what we refer to as a representative sample of online activity. And what we're largely trying to remove from that, or to minimize at the very least, are things like content spam, content that's not actually content. It was generated for no other reason than to try to game a search engine ranking, for example. Those are the types of expertise we tend to have on our end. And then we partner with institutions like the Library of Congress on very specialized collections. So we rely on their subject matter experts to really guide the focus of a collection, where we focus on trying to ensure that none of the materials that really are not of interest to researchers or the general public find their way into the collection.
Here's Clark in Washington, D.C. Go ahead, Clark. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a patent attorney, and I often use the Wayback Machine to gather evidence in a lawsuit. And I'm wondering if you have had experience with the authenticity of the archives being challenged in court.
Fascinating question. Chris Carpenter?
So I personally have not had any experience with that. I do know that there have been cases where there have been challenges raised to whether or not websites can be certified as a level of I guess if it pats muster in terms of its evidentiary value in a particular case. But I do know that we try to provide as much information individuals that are seeking resources that will help, especially in the context of a patent claim and prior art.
Clark, I'm fascinated. Have you had any similar experience? Court case? Fake website? Clark? I was wondering if you had any such experiences that caused you to raise the issue.
Quite often, a patent attorney will go out and try to find, a prior publication that someone described a product on the web. And I've never actually had an evidentiary challenge about the authenticity of a web page, but it seems to me that it could be something that could be suspect. And it sounds like the Internet Archive has had experience with assisting people in finding these prior art references. Is that correct?
Yes, when requested.
Okay, Clark, thank you very much for your call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls at 800-433-8850 on this Tech Tuesday, or you can send your email to kojo@wamu.org. What digital technology and websites do you think are most historically significant? 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, we explore the enlightening, though sometimes frightening, research about the effects of stress on the human body. Plus, Christopher Buckley on his latest satirical novel about Judge Judy's appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. Today at 1 on The Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Next time on Tell Me More, it's our weekly visit with the Mocha Moms, our roundtable of mothers and fathers who offer their advice on everything from housework to homework, to creating a balance between career and kids.
There are days that we do nothing but watch television and we just enjoy being together. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's the Hallmark card.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join the Mochas next time on Tell Me More.
Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Bike DC, a community bike ride being held on Saturday, September 27th. 17 car-free miles of bicycling. Details and registration online at bikedc.net. From the University of Pennsylvania, EMTM, Penn's Executive Masters in Technology Management Program, hosts an information session in Tyson's Corner on Thursday, September 25th. More information at 877-444-EMTM.
72 degrees now in Northwest Washington at 17 minutes before 1 o'clock. You're listening to the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking with Chris Carpenter, director of the web group at the Internet Archive. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. In our Washington studio is Martha Anderson, director of program management for the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program at the Library of Congress. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Martha, when consumers look at new high-tech applications, we tend to have short-term questions in mind. How am I going to get this YouTube video to play on my new computer? When you look at the same thing, you ask a slightly different question. How are we going to play this in the next century when people aren't even using Macs or PCs anymore, right?
That is correct. And we don't have a crystal ball, so we try to take it kind of a generation at a time. And one time we described our work as, let's keep this alive 5 years or till the next change in technology. But actually, we are learning a lot more about how the data itself can help it survive. In other words, if data is well described and well documented, that's why we really are challenged by new forms like YouTube. We were working really hard on how video was presented on the web. And a couple of years ago, within months, all the video changed to the YouTube format.
Uh-huh.
So we had to scramble and understand better how that format is put together. We actually have work going on at the Library of Congress to assess formats and try to judge what aspects of those formats will survive or will make them more survivable into the future, and how can we adopt plans and approaches to help us move to next generations of technology. So we do have to watch technology, as we say.
Chris Carpenter, this raises all kinds of questions about what kind of information might be lost during these transitions. The cynical side of one may think that outgoing administrations, political administrations, would try to bury things they find unflattering, but there's probably a bigger problem with unintentional deletion, is there not?
Absolutely. You know, as much as there certainly are intentional removals of content, and we've certainly seen that with reports that were published in PDF and suddenly someone up the chain wants it buried, 15 links down into a website, so it's much more difficult to locate, or just removed altogether. You know, those things happen, but they're very rare versus common. What is more likely to occur is, as you described, that someone who is maintaining a website is asked to update materials. There might have been a new set of reports or policy documents that were published, and instead of actually adding a page and displaying the new information, they might literally remove an existing page, or at least the contents of that page, and replace it with the new data. The older information is no longer accessible from that website, and that is a very common practice that continues.
And of course, there are deliberate attempts to remove stuff from websites, but then somebody, some way, finds it anyway. Tell us the story about China and the Olympic gymnasts, Chris.
Well, in this particular case, we had a group of concerned citizens and members of the media who, scratched their heads and said, there's something not quite right with this whole situation here, claims of specific ages and so forth. And so these groups went out and started scouring resources, specifically publications by the Chinese government regarding athletes that might be competing.
And we're talking, of course, about the controversy of the 2008 Olympics about the ages of some of the young Chinese gymnasts. Yes, correct.
And they actually found materials that referenced that these girls were, in some cases, 2 years younger than they were being represented to be during competition. Now, those materials were immediately removed by the Chinese government and are no longer accessible via the web. But those organizations were able to locate them through those Chinese websites and at least create an image, a snapshot of those pages. So, again, it may not hold up in court in terms of being hard and fast evidence. But this is an example of, something published through a federal channel that is then removed when it's no longer in the interest of that government to have it publicly accessible.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. We got an email from Daniel who says the National Archives, the Library of Congress, are working with a new system of storing documents so that they can be permanent. For many federal agencies, permanent URLs for documents are created to point to the documents, even if the documents are moved on a website. For example, the Library of Congress is using Handle System for all legislation. In addition, the nature of web architecture is moving toward an easier-to-archive design, also known as RESTful, or the web as one big object database. All this bodes well for archiving, especially compared to the days of paper only, where we wouldn't be able to do this beyond repository libraries. Martha Anderson?
He's right. There are, as the web has enabled communities to work together around common interest, there has been more cooperation, let's say. I think where our challenge still is the web is still an innovative place, and people will always be creative and try new things. And there's no way to tell every webmaster in the country that they should do their work a certain way. But there is The web does provide us with a way to bring people together, to have common discussions and to work together. I wanted to say that earlier I appreciated Joel's comments about, as a webmaster, about his need to find things, because things do get lost in the closet on the server, so to speak. And it was really good to hear him talk about
that. One of the major benefits of digital technology, of course, is that you can duplicate it relatively easily.
Yes, yes.
Talk about this, Chris Carpenter. This election, we've seen a lot of political discussions migrate onto social networking sites like Facebook and Flickr. But those sites are not part of current political crawl programs.
That's true. We do have some of those resources identified, especially in the context of candidates. If a candidate is pointing to an official Facebook page where they might be promoting a certain line of discourse or dialogue, then those materials have been prioritized for a collection as part of, for example, the Library of Congress election crawls. In general, most institutions, not-for-profit or otherwise, have been extremely conservative where social networks are concerned. There still are huge questions of privacy and access to content that really is sort of defined by the individual. And that's where, in my example earlier in the show, we talked a little bit about getting individual permissions from users of these networks who go in and say, it's okay for you to, you know, be, you know, on my shoulder, if you will, experiencing what I'm experiencing, so that you can preserve this, you know, for the next generation, that they can understand how the web changed, you know, my participation in the election process.
Martha, one of the things I find really interesting is that the government actually preserves this information in a number of separate locations. Why?
Well, this goes back a long way, this idea of multiple copies of information. And I'll, since I work at the Library of Congress, please indulge me to tell a Thomas Jefferson story.
Oh, please, yes. That's why we invited you.
Thomas, you know, the collection at the Library of Congress was built upon Jefferson's library after a disastrous fire caused during the War of 1812. But we found in Jefferson's letters a concern. He was writing to a man named Ebenezer Hazard in 1791, and he was writing about how he was worried about public documents and that the information would be lost, or either by time or accident, as he referred to it. And we know that accident can sometimes cause it. It's not intentional. And so his remedy, he was suggesting to Mr. Hazard that the remedy would be to make copies and distribute them around so that people could see them and not lock them up in vaults, but make them widely available. And that's the principle that has informed the government depository libraries that the government printing office has administered for years. And it also is proving to be a good principle for digital preservation, as we call it. The fact that we can have multiple copies, they can be taken care of by different organizations who have different technical environments. You know, you can't always bet on the same kind of server hardware, the same kinds of software. So we're betting on horses here, in a way, for the future. But the duplication, also geographically, we know there's a risk. In California, they have earthquakes. Here in Washington, we have other risk. So we try to share that and share the risk across the partnerships. So multiple copies is a long-standing tradition from the days of the Founding Father.
No wonder they call them the Founding Fathers. Digital wisdom from a Founding Father. Mm-hmm. That's why they call it the wisdom of the ages, I guess.
Yes.
Chris Carpenter, the Internet Archive works with a number of companies that keep track of Internet traffic to get a sense of which websites are being visited most heavily. But some of this data also may raise privacy issues, doesn't it?
Well, we actually do not archive traffic data for that very reason. We do have a number of organizations, mostly privately held businesses, that contribute Kroll data. So when they've gone out and visited various corners of the web and taken a snapshot of the activity at a given point in time, they will then donate those materials to our archival collections. To date, we've been very conservative with any sort of traffic data, anything that could be linked back to an individual or at a personalized level. We're very concerned about privacy issues and access to that type of data.
I'm also concerned, Martha Anderson, about preservation issues. If we were talking about reel-to-reel tapes, we'd be worried that the sound fidelity of these items would erode over time. Is there a problem, any problem, with erosion when it comes to digital media?
It's not erosion in the same way that you are concerned. So the fidelity may stay the same, but the actual information itself may be corrupted in such a way that you can't read it. The software you have is not able to read it. I don't know if you've ever had experience with a file that you ended abruptly, and then when you went back, you couldn't open it.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing can happen. Again, that's why the multiple copies, the multiple technical environments are a strategy to waylay this. When we move content around, when we move data around, we do integrity checks to be sure that the data that came, when our collections come from the Internet Archive to us. Internet Archive collects, they send us a copy. When that copy comes, we run checks to be sure that the data is exactly the copy, a copy that they sent, and hasn't changed in any way at all. And then over time, we monitor to be sure that. So it's not so much the lack of fidelity, it's the fact that you just can't even get to the data once if it's corrupted.
Chris Carpenter, the Library of Congress keeps track of all of the federal races that take place. Are you partnering with any state or local groups that are attempting to keep track of state or local races?
We do have state institutions, both at the both archives and libraries, that work with us using a subscription service that we offer that allows them to go in and prioritize a set of sites for collection and then access. So those sites are collected at whatever frequency those institutions define. They're then indexed for full-text search and for access via the Wayback Machine. And many of those institutions on the state level are focused on collection of both election materials that occur in natural election cycles within those states, but also just ongoing archives of their published government materials at the state and local level.
Chris Carpenter is director of the web group at the Internet Archive. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martha Anderson is director of program management for the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program at the Library of Congress. Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure to join you.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, a cutting-edge program to improve our environment, how Maryland is using business world strategies to make companies reduce air pollution, plus the future of higher education. A former college president explains why human history is a race between education and catastrophe. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
And good afternoon. You are listening to WAMU. I'm Stephanie Kay, sitting in this week for Bill.